From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The fact of the matter is that if you really look over history, including our own, the threats to survival are considered quite marginal, ranked rather low on the value scale as compared with others like enhancing global dominance.
Peering into the abyss of the future, as President Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin sign a new nuclear arms treaty that paves the way for Star Wars, we hear MIT professor Noam Chomsky talk about the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. global domination. That and more coming up on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rules. I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman. Amy is making the long trip back from East Timor. These are some of the headlines today. President George Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin agreed today to sign a nuclear arms treaty, or signed a nuclear arms treaty today. Both are hailing the agreement as ushering in a new era of global security, yet the treaty does not require the destruction of a single warhead. The agreement is also expected to pave the way for Bush's unilateral withdrawal from the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty so he can build a Star Wars global system. More on that story in a minute. President Bush yesterday used a keynote speech of his European tour to warn Europeans that they face a lethal threat from terrorists. Bush told German parliamentarians it is in their own interest to back the broadening so-called war on terror. As he spoke, four German MPs unfurled a banner that read, "Mr. Bush and Mr. Schroeder, stop your wars." Then they walked out in protest. Outside the meeting, tens of thousands of people demonstrated against the U.S. wars. The protests were mostly peaceful and were organized by an alliance of some 250 peace, anti-globalization, and environmental groups called the Axis of Peace. Police arrested 50 people. New Pentagon documents released on Thursday revealed the Defense Department sprayed live nerve gas and biological agents on ships and sailors in the Pacific Ocean in the 1960s. According to the documents, the Cold War era experiments sought to see how quickly the sailors could detect the poisons, how rapidly the ships would disperse, and to test the effectiveness of protective gear and decontamination procedures. The influential Indian newspaper, the Hindustan Times, is reporting India will give Pakistan 2 months to stop cross-border attacks in Kashmir before military action is taken. Meanwhile, Pakistan is preparing to move troops from the Afghan border to the Indian border. Islamabad is also said to be recalling its 4,000 peacekeeping troops from Sierra Leone. Meanwhile, the London Guardian is reporting that despite the growing threat of war between the nuclear-armed neighbors, Britain is still trying to profit from the Indian arms market. British ministers have been pushing the sale of 60 Hawk jets worth over $1.5 billion. Foreign Secretary Jack Straw has warned that the Kashmir crisis is now potentially more dangerous than the Middle East, and the government has imposed a de facto arms embargo on Israel. But the Tony Blair government said yesterday that its policy on arms sales to India or Pakistan has not changed. The Israeli army is stringing barbed wire around the entire Palestinian city of Ramallah in the West Bank. International aid officials worry that this is the beginning of a plan the Israeli army outlined earlier this month, which would create 8 zones around every major city in the West Bank. Palestinians needing to travel would apply for a special day-only permit to enter or leave a particular zone. The World Bank representative who attended the meeting with the army said the closures would have a devastating effect on the economy and will further impoverish the Palestinians. The Israeli army responded to questioning with this Orwellian statement, quote, "The coordinator of government activities acts to make easier the situation for the Palestinian population. To that end, a procedure was suggested to facilitate the passage between areas in the West Bank," end of quote. Israeli peace activists are outraged. Meanwhile, Israeli authorities say a Palestinian attempted to bomb a popular nightclub in Tel Aviv on Thursday. A guard shot him dead. Israeli tanks invaded the Gaza Strip later that night and blew up 3 factories. Also last night in Tel Aviv, 4,000 people and some of Israel's leading DJs turned out for a rave against the occupation. The Israeli newspaper Haaretz is reporting the rave was a spontaneous initiative undertaken by young people and wasn't sponsored by any official political movement. Prominent left-wing leaders watched from the sidelines. The Senate voted overwhelmingly last night to grant President Bush fast-track negotiating authority on trade. The bill provides some compensation to workers. Workers who lose their jobs due to corporate-led globalization will receive more benefits. The House has already passed a bill granting fast-track authority. Congress is expected to enact a compromise version of the two bills later this year. And that's some of the headlines for today. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Juan Gonzalez, sitting in for Amy Goodman, who's heading back from East Timor. President George Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin signed a nuclear arms treaty today. The treaty doesn't require either side to destroy a single missile launcher or warhead. Instead, it allows them to keep weapons in storage where they can be reactivated on short notice. The treaty's only real constraint is that each side must have no more than 2,200 warheads by the year 2012. But that's when the treaty expires. So each can actually have as many weapons as it likes unless the treaty is extended. And both sides have far more strategic nuclear warheads than they need. The Pentagon itself called for reducing its active warheads to the number in its own classified strategy documents. The agreement is also expected to pave the way for Bush's unilateral withdrawal from the 1972 anti-ballistic missile treaty so he can build a Star Wars global missile system. Bush said the signing ended a long chapter of confrontation and opened up an entirely new relationship between our countries. Putin called the treaty, quote, a serious move ahead to ensure international security. Well, we now turn to a speech by MIT professor Noam Chomsky on the past and future of nuclear weapons and their role in global domination. But nuclear weapons will not be the only topic of discussion between Bush and Putin over the next few days. Newsweek is reporting the two could also form a so-called energy security pact. Under the agreement, Russia would offer to make up any shortfalls in oil supplies to the West when there are crises in other parts of the world, such as the Middle East. We now turn to Professor Noam Chomsky. He begins by talking about America's long pursuit of oil in the Middle East. He then turns to the issue of America's nuclear weapons and global domination. Noam Chomsky is a professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He is a leading scholar and critic of U.S. foreign policy and the author of many books, including 9-1-1, recently published by Seven Stories Press. He gave this speech in March at Stanford University.
After September 11th, some of the press, particularly the Wall Street Journal, did do what they should have done. They began investigating opinion in the region to find out why people, they were trying to find out the answer to George Bush's plaintive question, why do they hate us when we're so good? You know, how can that be? So before he asked the question, the Wall Street Journal had provided some of the answers. They did do what they should have done. They did a investigation of opinions in the region. Now they kept to the people they care about. So they had it was what they called moneyed Muslims, meaning bankers, lawyers, managers of branches of U.S. corp transnationals, that kind of people. People are right inside the U.S. system. And of course, naturally despise Osama bin Laden because they're his main targets. They're the ones he's after, so they don't like him. And in that group, what's their opinion about the United States? Well, it turns out they're They're very antagonistic to U.S. policy, though they're in the main policies they're just part of, you know, like the international economic policies. But what they object to is the fact that the United States has consistently opposed a democracy, a independent development, supporting corrupt, brutal regimes, they're naturally strongly opposed to the unilateral U.S. support for the Israeli military occupation, which is very harsh and brutal. It's now in its 35th year, strongly opposed the U.S. sanctions against Iraq, which they understand perfectly well, and you know too, so I won't go into it, are devastating the population but strengthening Saddam Hussein. And they remember, another thing that we like to forget, that the United States and Britain supported him right through his worst atrocities, helped him, continued to help him develop weapons of mass destruction, didn't see anything wrong with gassing Kurds or anything else. They remember that, even if we choose to sweep it under the carpet. And for reasons like that, they say they, you know, have a lot of hatred of U.S. policies, despite the fact that they're right in the middle of the entire U.S. system. Well, that's one answer to George Bush's question. It's not the kind of answer you read in most of the intellectual journals and the press and so on. There you read sophisticated answers about how people of that region have bad cultures, or they are left out by globalization, or they, you know, can't stand their freedoms and their magnificence and so on and so forth. Anyone who is seriously concerned with these issues, certainly anyone who's a specialist in international affairs or the Middle East, knows that there's nothing new about these answers. You can go way back and find them as far back as you want to go. One of the good places to look, one of the advantages of living here, is that the United States has become, over the years, a very free country. Not a gift from the gods, but as a result of plenty of popular struggle, it's become a unusually free country, uniquely so in some respects. We have more information about U.S. high-level U.S. policy planning than you can find about any country in the world that I know about. Tons of declassified material, which shows how policy is being conducted and what the thinking is. Well, obvious place to look, if you want to find out more about this, is the records for 1958. The reason is that 1958 was a critical year in U.S. international affairs for a lot of reasons. I'll explain it later if you like, but in particular with regard to the Middle East. It was a critical year because it was the first year in which some country, namely Iraq, had been able to break out of the Anglo-American condominium over the world's energy resources. Iran had tried, conservative nationalist regime, but they were there was a military coup, that U.S.-British military coup that overthrew it. Iraq actually broke out, and it was a huge issue, big flurry of activity, military forces all over the place, almost came to nuclear weapons. It was an enormous issue. So if you want to understand what the U.S. was thinking about, you look back to those records. Well, if you do, you find that President Eisenhower, in internal discussion, observed to his staff, his words, that there's a campaign of hatred against us in the Middle East, not by governments, but by the people. And there was discussion about this. The National Security Council, the highest planning body, gave their analysis. They said that the reason is that there's a perception in the region that the United States is supporting harsh and brutal and corrupt regimes, and is blocking democratization and development, and is doing so because of our interest in controlling the oil reserves of the region. And they said it's difficult to counter this perception because it's accurate. And not only is it accurate, but it should be accurate. It said it is natural for us to support status quo governments, meaning the kind I just described, and to prevent democracy and development because we want to maintain control over the energy resources of the region. So there's a campaign of hatred against us by the people, and that's the reason for it. Essentially the same as what the Wall Street Journal discovered on September 14th, Anybody knew in between. The only difference is that, of course, some of the specific policies, like the sanctions against Iraq, are new and so on, but the general policies are the same. And they're talking about the people, not just money Muslims. And among the people, there's a much deeper resentment because they don't see any particular reason why the wealth of the region should flow to the West and to the moneyed Muslims, but who are cooperating with the West and not to them. Kind of backward cultures, as you read, and this idea somehow hasn't penetrated their minds and still hasn't. So there's an even deeper campaign of hatred among the people who aren't moneyed Muslims in the middle of the U.S. system. So if you want to listen to some voices outside the cocoon, it's not hard to hear them, and they'll answer the questions about why there's a campaign of hatred against us, whether it's now or in 1958, and in a good part of the rest of the world, where people just don't enjoy being ground to dust under somebody's boot. They don't like it, and leads to hatred. You can avoid, you know, you can indulge in the fantasies if you like, but that's a choice. You certainly don't have to. There's a lot more to say about this, but let me put these relatively topical issues aside and look at some other things. A couple of weeks ago, you read certainly the front page stories on George Bush's, current Bush's, nuclear posture review. And that was kind of interesting. It wasn't interesting because of the content. There was almost nothing new in the content. What was interesting is that it was reported, that it had been leaked and reported. And since the content is essentially the same as everything that preceded, which was already public though not reported, one wants to know why was it suddenly leaked and reported. And here we can only speculate, but my guess is that there probably are people inside the administration who aren't happy about the fact that certified lunatics have their hand very close to the button. Some of them you may actually have run into on the Stanford campus. But there have been a number of leaks recently which kind of suggest that there's a concern that, you know, things may really get out of hand, even from the point of view of elite interests. Anyway, that's a guess. What is not a guess is that the content of the nuclear posture review, insofar as it was revealed, is pretty much the same as the preceding 10 years. Right after the end of the Cold War, you know, when the Berlin Wall fell and no more Russians, discussions of tactical changes to deal with the new situation. Some of it was public, and what's public is really sufficient to natural again, but sufficient to gain an understanding of what's happening and where we're heading and some other abysses into which we might peer, much deeper ones than international terrorism in this case. The first conclusion, which was correct by the Joint Chiefs, was that the U.S. is no longer facing what is called technically a weapons-rich environment. Russia is a weapons-rich environment, you know, particular place, ton of weapons. We're not facing that any longer. We're now facing a target-rich environment, that is, the rest of the world, which is a lot of targets but not many weapons. So we have to switch planning from a weapons-rich environment to a target-rich environment. In fact, the target-rich environment had always been the focus of military action, but under the pretext that we were protecting ourselves from the weapons-rich environment. Now, that's gone. The pretext is gone, and also the deterrent is gone. That was understood right away. That opens up lots of new opportunities. It does require new pretexts and new tactics. The pretexts now couldn't be any longer. Basically, the plans remained more or less the same, except that you can now shift to mini nukes, you know, little nuclear weapons that you can use against places that aren't weapons rich. What's called adaptive planning, new techniques for dealing with small countries that you want to destroy. And the description changed. The pretext changed. So by March 1990, just a couple of months after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the public documents of the first Bush administration explained publicly, it wasn't reported, but it was public, that in their presentations to Congress about the Pentagon, why we have to have the same old Pentagon system, even though there's no more Russians, they explained that the reason now is not that the Russians are coming, but it's the technological sophistication of third world countries. That's the phrase. That's why we need all this stuff. And we also have to target any country that's capable of producing weapons of mass destruction.
You're listening to Noam Chomsky dissecting the U.S. nuclear arms buildup. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Juan Gonzalez, filling in for Amy Goodman. As President Bush and Russian President Putin sign a new nuclear arms pact that paves the way for Star Wars, we return to a speech by Noam Chomsky on the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. global domination.
Well, let me give you some of the flavor of the Clinton-era documents, which are worth listening to, and you might compare them with the current nuclear posture review. It says, this is Clinton. The United States should have a this is strategic command, you know, the highest level part of the Pentagon that deals with strategic weapons, STRATCOM. This is from a crucial document of theirs, which was gotten on the Freedom of Information Act a couple of years ago, called Essentials of Post-Cold War Deterrence. So major thinking about how to carry out what's called deterrence. Deterrence, of course, means attack. In the post-war period. And it says the U.S. should have available the full range of responses, but nuclear weapons are the most important of these because unlike chemical or biological weapons, the extreme destruction from a nuclear explosion is immediate with few, if any, palliatives to reduce its effect. And then it says, though we are not likely, thank goodness for that, we're not likely to use nuclear weapons in less than matters of the greatest national importance or in less than extreme circumstances. They have to be available all the time because they cast their shadow over any crisis or conflict, and we therefore have to have them. Then there's a section called Maintaining Ambiguity, and it says it's important that planners should not be too rational about determining what the opponent values the most. It all has to be targeted. It hurts to portray ourselves as too fully rational and cool-headed, that the United States may become irrational and vindictive if its vital interests are attacked, should be part of the national persona we project. It's beneficial for our strategic posture if some elements may appear to be potentially out of control. And it goes on to say, if this sounds familiar, it's not an accident. Nuclear weapons seem destined to be the centerpiece of U.S. strategic deterrence for the foreseeable future. We must therefore reject any no-first-use policy. There never has been one, but we must not institute one. We make it clear that our reaction may either be response or preemptive. Actually, that notion of preemptive reaction is an interesting one, which tells you what deterrence means. So we have to have preemptive reaction, which means undermining the stated goal of the non-proliferation treaty. We should not agree to any so-called negative security assurances that ban the use of nuclear weapons against non-nuclear states that are parties to the treaty. All of this has apparently been confirmed by Clinton's internal nuclear posture review, parts of which have been declassified, and subsequent presidential directives. So that's the old nuclear posture stand, and the new one is not very different. Interesting question is why it was suddenly publicized. Heard my guess. For the future, we also have to face for ourselves, now back to terrorism, the fact that small nukes can be smuggled into any country, including the United States, with no difficulty. There's a recent high-level technical report, I'm quoting it, which says, well-planned operations to smuggle weapons of mass destruction into the United States would have at least a 90% probability of success, much higher than ICBM delivery. So that raises the question, what's missile defense about if those threats are so enormous? And the answer is the missile defense program does have an effect on existing threats, namely it enhances them. And furthermore, that's understood. It's not a secret. So much of the fuss about ballistic missile defense these days is criticism about whether it'll work. So critics say it's not going to work, too easy to fool it. But I think they're missing the point. It's much more dangerous if it looks like it might work. It's enough for it to look as though it might work, because in this kind of deadly game, appearance and reality are the same thing. Nobody can take a chance. So if it looks like it might work, potential adversaries, are going to have to interpret the system as if it would work. They have to, just as we would if it was inverted. And U.S. intelligence has been very clear about the consequences. They point out, have for years, this Clinton years, that if the U.S. deploys a system that looks realistic, that's going, I'm quoting now, that'll impel China to develop new nuclear-armed missiles, expanding its arsenal tenfold, probably with MIRVs, multiple warheads, prompting India and Pakistan to respond with their own buildups. That then leads to a ripple effect throughout the Middle East. And same intelligence officials predict that Russia and China both would increase proliferation, including selling countermeasures to such nations as North Korea, Iran, and Iraq, and Syria. They also point out that Russia's only rational response to the national missile defense system would be to maintain and strengthen the existing Russian nuclear force. Yeah, that's the analysis of U.S. intelligence about deploying a system that has even a likelihood of working. The Bush administration agrees. They announced on September 1st that they have no objection to China. I'm reading the quoting from the press now. They have no objection to China's plans to build up its small fleet of nuclear missiles. That's shifting policy pretty sharply in the hope of getting Chinese acquiescence to the then planned, now implemented, demolition of the ABM treaty. For similar reasons, Clinton's negotiators had already encouraged Russia to adopt what's called a launch-on-warning strategy, computerized strategy that says, you know, if some computer senses a danger, send off the missiles. Clinton negotiators had urged Russia to do that. Same reason, to try to get them to acquiesce to the programs we're carrying out. Some experts, nuclear experts who were asked about this, regarded it as, in their words, pretty bizarre, because we know that their computerized systems are deteriorating, their warning systems are deteriorating and full of holes, prone to false alarms. That increases the threat of Russian unauthorized accidental or erroneous launches, meaning destruction, we're finished, you know, and that increases the threat. The administration also announced plans to, September 1st again, to share detailed information on its missile defense programs with China. That's going to enhance China's capacity to overcome any U.S. Systems and also to transfer information to others who have similar concerns about being targeted. Strategic analysts point out that that change of policy encourages China to aim more nuclear-armed missiles at the United States and Japan, with the expected effect on Japanese and Taiwanese programs, as well as India, and then onwards. Same day that all this was reported, the national press also reported independently that the U.S. was about to impose sanctions on China for allowing the transfer to Pakistan of missile parts and technology that are essentially for weapons that can carry nuclear warheads. It's all happening at the same time. And it's understood, programs like missile defense increase the danger of destruction for the United States and for others. But that's just not important. And furthermore, it's not new. That's the whole history of, that's military history, including the history of the arms race for the last 50 years. So just think about that. 50 years ago, around 1950, there was only one, the U.S. had an overwhelming security, but there was a potential threat on the horizon. It didn't exist yet, but it might come into existence. That was ICBMs with thermonuclear warheads. They weren't around, but sooner or later they would come around. What was the reaction? It was understood. You know, everybody knew that is a real potential threat to the United States. How is it dealt with? Well, there's a history of the standard history, the arms race, by McGeorge Bundy. He was Kennedy Johnson National Security Advisor. He had access to internal records and so on. And he writes in his history that he could find no record of any interest, even any interest, in pursuing the possibility of banning these things, which the Russians probably would have accepted. They were so far behind and so much more threatened by them that there's every possibility they would have agreed to a treaty that banned them. But there was never any interest in this, even though it was the only potential threat to the United States and a non-trivial threat. Eisenhower once pointed out that a nuclear war would destroy the Northern Hemisphere. That was a threat, but there was no interest in trying to even move towards negotiations that might deter it. The fact of the matter is that if you really look over history, including our own, the threats to survival are considered quite marginal, ranked rather low on the value scale as compared with others like enhancing global dominance. That's a kind of a constant throughout history. The difference today is the scale of the threat, which is significant. There's a lot of, as you know, lots of Russian archives have been coming out. Actually, people are poring over them to see if they can find some justification for U.S. Cold War policies, and there's not much. But there is some interesting material coming out. Part of what's coming out of the Russian archives is a confirmation of what had already been discussed by U.S. strategic analysts, some of them from inside the intelligence community in the Pentagon, who left and have described it. Now it's confirmed by the Russian archives. The basic story is that, confirmed now by the archival sources on both sides, is that after Stalin's death, after Khrushchev took over mid-50s, his view was that the United States, in his words, was using the arms race to destroy the far weaker Soviet economy and by that means to obtain its goals even without war. Point is, as he and everybody else knew, the U.S. economy is far larger. If the U.S. runs an extensive arms race and the Russians try to keep up, it'll destroy their economy. And Khrushchev understood that that's U.S. policy. He therefore, over the strong objections of his own military command, we now know this from Russian sources, he initiated a sharp reduction in Soviet offensive military forces and called on the United States to reciprocate. Well, the Eisenhower administration considered it and rejected it, but the death blow to this was given by the Kennedy administration. At that point, Khrushchev made really sharp cuts, called for reciprocity. It was discussed internally and rejected. I'll just quote from the leading scholarly study of the archival records on both sides by Matthew Evangelista. He points out that the Kennedy refusal and their choice instead of a huge escalation of offensive armament, he said that drove the last nail into the coffin of Khrushchev's agenda of restraining the Soviet military. He was kicked out soon after that, and the arms race picks up and goes on. That's confirmed by internal U.S. sources. Now we have it from both sides. The Soviet reaction to the Kennedy escalation and rejection of these efforts also terminated Khrushchev's reformist programs internally. They might have averted, in fact, it's not impossible, they would have averted this whole social and economic catastrophes, for the, first of all, the stagnation of the Soviet economy from the 1960s, which was a result of this, and the immense human catastrophe of the past decade, which is almost historically without precedent, as well as the destruction of Afghanistan, all kind of other atrocities, not to speak of the very serious danger of nuclear destruction, because it's come very close in the past 40 years. But all of that was evidently regarded as a kind of secondary concern by the Kennedy planners and their predecessors and indeed their successors. Well, without going on with this, there isn't any real novelty in the Clinton and Bush preferences. You look over time, the correlation between security policies and concern for security is very weak. It's historically the case. It's the case now. So what's the ballistic missile defense for? Well, the first thing to bear in mind about it is that everyone takes it to be an offensive weapon, not a defensive weapon. And that's a kind of doctrinal truism. When you hear the word defense, you interpret it as meaning offense. And in this case, it's assumed that that's assumed both by adversaries and by advocates. So, for example, these plans have, of course, been escalated, all of them, not just the missile defense plans, but the much bigger plans for militarization of space, of which they're a small component. They were escalated very sharply after September 11th. The Bush administration saw kind of a window of opportunity to kind of exploit the fear and the concerns of the population and the demands for patriotism, meaning you shut up, to sharply escalate its own agenda on everything, including a major attack against the population, destroying social welfare systems. You know all about this. I don't have to go into it. But also vastly expanding the militarization programs, including the space militarization programs, which they know perfectly well pose a very severe danger far beyond international terrorism to the existence of not only the United States, but in this case, the human species. As I said, even the small component that's missile defense is understood to be an offensive weapon. So China, for example, says what everybody knows when they observe the top officials, that once the United States believes it has both a strong spear and a strong shield, it could lead them to conclude that nobody can harm the United States and they can harm anybody they like anywhere in the world. Well, the U.S. RAND Corporation, the top military analysis agency, they agree in the same words, virtually. They point out that ballistic missile defense, I'm quoting, is not simply a shield, but an enabler of U.S. action. And the logic is obvious. You have a shield, you have a spear. It's pretty obvious. And strategic analysts agree. So kind of at the right end of the spectrum in the journal National Interest, well-known analyst Andrew Bacevich writes that by insulating the homeland from reprisal, missile defense will underwrite the capacity and willingness of the United States to shape the environment elsewhere. And he cites approvingly a commentator from the liberal end of the spectrum, the opposite end, Lawrence Kaplan in the New Republic, who says missile defense isn't really meant to protect America, it's a tool for global dominance. It's about preserving America's ability to wield power abroad. It's not about defense, it's about offense, and that's exactly why we need it. He says it'll provide the United States with absolute freedom in using or threatening to use force in international relations. Kaplan, in the New Republic, repeats China's complaint, which he thinks is correct, and he approves of it, namely that it will give the United States the opportunity to do what it wants. It will, in his words, cement U.S. hegemony and make Americans masters of the world. And that's the way things should be. And for exactly that reason, he says, liberal critics are missing the point. They have things exactly backwards. He says missile defense will facilitate the kind of interventions that liberals champion, and therefore they should applaud it. Right? You get the logic.
You're listening to Democracy Now. I'm Juan Gonzalez. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Juan Gonzalez, filling in for Amy Goodman. The cut you heard was the Ramones, "We Want the Airwaves." As President Bush and Russian President Putin signed a new nuclear arms treaty, paving the way for Star Wars today, we return now to a speech by Noam Chomsky on the role of nuclear weapons in U.S. global domination.
Now, there is a kind of a problem about missile defense, kind of like a technical paradox, which you can see discussed in the even in journals like, say, Foreign Affairs, the main establishment journal. The problem is that missile defense relies on satellites, and satellites are very easy to shoot down. They're much easier to shoot down than missiles. Missiles, you don't know where they're going and, anything else. Satellites, they're right there. You can track them. Shooting down satellites is kind of like poor man's technology. So how can you have, if we destroy, as we already have, the anti-ABM treaties, well, that means anti-satellite weapons are now legitimate, and that undermines the possibility of missile defense, so it's kind of like a paradox. But there's an answer. The paradox is, it's at least in some imagined world, there's an answer. The answer is what's called full-spectrum dominance. That means such overwhelming superiority over everyone else that nobody can even use the poor man's weapon. Because we will have offensive weapons in space. Here's where the rest of the story comes in. We'll have offensive weapons in space of extreme destructive power, probably nuclear-powered, because there's no other way to get that much energy up there. And they'll be ready for launch with instant computer-controlled reaction, because can't waste any time in these cases. Very much increases the risk of total destruction, mass slaughter and destruction, if only because of what are called in the trade, literally, normal accidents. Normal accidents are the kind of accidents that occur in any complicated system, unpredictably. You know are going to occur, you just don't know when or why. I mean, anybody who has a computer or has tried to install DSL or take BART, like I took BART today, and at one point the doors decided they weren't going to open or something like that. That kind of thing is what's called a normal accident, and it's going to happen in any complicated system. It's almost provable. And this kind of thing guarantees normal accidents along the line. And that once the first one happens, you can say goodbye. That's the end of everything. Well, the goals of militarization of space, in fact, go way beyond this. And this is all public documents. There's no reason not to know it. The Clinton documents of the Space Command, in charge of this stuff, they actually publish brochures for public use. You know, like you look at the front page, and it's like a kind of thing that, you know, people give to corporate executives with big words and underlining so the dumbest person can follow it, that sort of thing. On the front page of the document, there's one called Vision for 2020, and it announces the primary goal of militarization of space, namely dominating the space dimension of military operations to protect U.S. interests and investment. And that's described accurately as the next plausible stage in a historic task. So in the earlier on, you know, countries developed armies, like the United States, they said, needed an army during the westward expansion of the continental United States, which, of course, was in self-defense. I don't have to comment about that. And nations also built navies to protect and enhance their commercial interests, and the next logical step is space forces, quoting still, to protect U.S. national interests, military and commercial, and investments. That's just normal. That includes national missile defense, but also space-based strike weapons enabling the application of precision force from, to, and through space. So that's the next step beyond navies. But this is going to be different from navies. In one crucial respect, the British could construct a huge navy, but it could be countered, like Germany could build a navy to counter it, and Japan could build a navy, and that had certain consequences, which we don't have to talk about. But this is going to be different. The reason is that the United States will be so far in the lead, so overwhelmingly dominant in militarization of space and placing destructive offensive military weapons there computer-controlled alert, that nobody will be able to counter it, at least in the imagined world. That'll make the U.S. immune. That's one of the reasons why we have to vastly outspend all adversaries and allies combined and even increase it further, requires total dominance. So nothing can counter U.S. hegemony, which, remember, is for the benefit of the world by logic. The U.S. will then remain immune except for one thing, that very narrowly circumscribed category of terrorism, which is allowed to enter the canon because somebody else does it to us. Well, they go on, interestingly, to say that this need for I'm talking about the military planners, the need for total dominance will increase as a result of the globalization of the world economy. Now, the reason is that globalization is expected to bring about a widening of the divide between the haves and the have-nots. That's an assessment which is shared by U.S. intelligence and by U.S. academic specialists. A big study was just put out under CIA auspices, but it's the whole intelligence agencies with outside academic experts and others. It's a planning for the next 15 years. And their conclusion is that globalization should proceed on course, though its evolution will be rocky, marked by chronic financial volatility, which incidentally translates into slower growth and more suffering for the poor majority, and also a widening economic divide. Okay, that's the prediction if everything works right. You know, slower growth and a widening economic divide. The military planners make the same assessment, and they're concerned that the widening divide is going to lead to unrest among the have-nots, you know, the growing numbers of have-nots, and that, of course, requires that the U.S. has the force to control it, quoting them, using space systems and planning for precision strike from space as a counter to the worldwide proliferation of weapons of mass destruction by unruly elements, which is a predictable consequence of the recommended programs and is pretty easy in the future, just as the widening divide is an expected consequence of the preferred form of globalization. Notice that that's counter to the economic theories that are professed, right? According to the economic theories that you study at Stanford, globalization is supposed to lead to a single market, right? That's the measure of international integration. But what's expected is exactly the opposite, namely it's going to lead to a widening divide, which is correct for the form of globalization that is intended. It's not international economic integration. It's a particular form of corporate-oriented globalization, which is sometimes described honestly. So like the Wall Street Journal describes what are presented publicly as free trade agreements. They call them free investment agreements, and that's correct. That kind of globalization, you expect to reduce globalization in the technical sense, but to increase it in the doctrinally preferred sense with much slower growth, which has been a characteristic of the past 25 years anyway. It's going to slow even more because of increasing financial volatility, more suffering, and a widening divide, meaning less globalization in the sense of an economics course, but more in the sense of reality, preferred doctrine at least. Well, they could have gone on to give a deeper historical background. It's getting late and I won't do it. But if you look at the history of industrialization, history of industrial development, you discover very quickly that since the 18th century, the modern industrial revolution, it's been very heavily military-based. That includes the American system of mass production that amazed the world in the 19th century, which came out of armories, Springfield Armory mainly. It includes the basis of the automotive industry. A century ago, the main technical problems in mechanical and electrical engineering had to do with things like placing a huge gun emplacement on a moving object, namely a ship, and trying to set it up so it could hit another moving object, namely another ship. Those were problems which are kind of analogous to the problems of space vehicles today. And working on those within the military system made it possible to socialize the costs and the risks, means the public pays for them under the military cover, but then privatize the profits if anything works out. And that's exactly what's expected from the current space system. And in fact, anyone who looks at the modern economy knows that's how it developed. So the so-called new economy, computers and telecommunications and all that kind of stuff, almost entirely comes out of the very dynamic state sector. That's why if you look at the World Trade Organization rules, they have a thing called a national security exemption, which means that you're allowed to violate the rules for national security. Well, national security means anything having to do with the military, and for the United States, that means the whole cutting edge of the economy for the last 50 years and for the future, and in fact, the good bit of the past, and the same for other industrial countries. Doesn't do Haiti much good, but for the guys who run the world, the masters of the universe, it does them a lot of good. Well, throughout history, it has been understood that all of this is very dangerous, and in fact, that's... We have a history of wars that tells us how dangerous it is. What's different now is just the scale, and the scale is qualitatively different. It's not slight differences. Well, I'm going to stop. There's a lot more to say about all of this. These are some, not all, of the deep abysses into which we ought to be peering. The good side of the story, which there really is less need to talk about because we all know it and we don't have to congratulate ourselves on achievements, but there have been plenty of them. I mentioned that we're now commemorating the 40th anniversary of the attack on South Vietnam without any notice. The reason there's no notice is because there was no protest at that point in, say, Berkeley or anywhere else. Nobody cared if the United States was going to start bombing another country and attack it with chemical warfare. That's fine. That's what we do. No American president could conceivably do anything like that today. It took years at that time before any protest developed. Out of that protest and the parallel civil rights movement and other popular developments, big changes took place. The changes that took place over the past 30 or 40 years have made the country a lot more civilized. There couldn't conceivably have been a meeting like this 40 years ago, or probably even 20 years ago. There's been a constant improvement. Places just a lot more civilized in lots of dimensions. You go back to the 1960s, there was no feminist movement, there was no environmental movement, which meant nobody cared if there's not going to be if there won't be an environment in which our grandchildren could survive, just wasn't an issue. There were no solidarity movements, no mass anti-nuclear movement, no anti-apartheid movement, no anti-sweatshop movements, no movements opposing international economic integration of the investor rights style, which was already going on. Nothing. You know. I mean, there's some, but not very much, kind of marginal. Now it's enormous. Furthermore, it's worldwide. Particularly with regard to international economic integration, what's ludicrously called globalization, that or free trade or one of these other propaganda terms, opposition to that has been going on extensively in the South, like in Brazil and in India, for years, for decades, in fact. Finally, in the last couple of years, it hit the North in Seattle. That's why you constantly read. And when it's in the North, you can't ignore it. You know. Like if it's just hundreds of thousands of Indian peasants and so on, you can kind of pretend it's not happening. But when you see it in the streets of Seattle, it's happening. So therefore, that's called the beginning of the anti-globalization movement, which is ridiculous for one thing, because it's not opposed to globalization. Nobody sane is opposed to that. And it's not starting in the North. We're coming along behind. But it's a good thing because it's the first time ever, that there has been a real international, the beginnings of a real international. That's what's been the core ideal of the left and the working class movement since their beginning in the 19th century. And this is the first seeds of it. In Porto Alegre in Brazil a month ago, it was very impressive. 60, 70,000 people from all over the world, south, north, every possible, peasants, workers, environmentalists, all kinds of activists, essentially working on the same things, and very seriously. I mean, the descriptions in the press, which are comical because they're terrified. They're terrified of what's going on, and rightly. What's going on are substantial popular movements which are completely unprecedented in scale, are growing out of the changes that have been taking place over the past few decades. It continues a historical course. I mean, there's been a long struggle to attain more rights, more democratic control, and it's continuing and probably accelerating. And it's a tendency running counter to the tendency towards destruction. And exactly which curve is going to move up faster will determine the fate of the species. That question is pretty much in the hands of people like you.
That was Noam Chomsky speaking at Stanford University last March on the dangers of the nuclear weapons buildup. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, and Lizzie Ratner. Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. You can go to our website at www.pacificanow.org, and you can mail us at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. I'm Juan Gonzalez. Amy will be back in the studio on Monday. Thanks for listening.
Working together now to make our lives mercifully brief. And school kids keep trying to teach us what guns are all about.